Good morning, brethren and sisters. The book of Ecclesiastes, as we've been considering, is really a book of study and deep meditation. As we discussed during our two previous classes, it's essentially regarding the search for happiness and satisfaction. And as we quite clearly saw yesterday, many of the things which the world suggests will provide us with happiness and satisfaction provide us with the very reverse. They provide us with the empty feeling which life is, vanity. What is good? What is real? What is worthwhile? And the eternal question, what is the great purpose and meaning of life? That question is particularly pertinent in the chapter we wish to consider this morning. To everything there is a purpose. There is a season or a time. This chapter is known by many in the world. There's a time for this and there's a time for that. Even songs have been written about it. But the point of the matter is, it's not we recognize that there's a time for everything, it's how we practically recognize there's a time for everything. Because we are so often guilty of carrying on our lives with a capricious acceptance of whatever life throws at us without objectively analyzing what the purpose of things are and whether it's right for us to do certain things. We must remember that overarching everything, overarching all our considerations and everything we do in life, all our ambitions, all our aims, we must keep in mind that there is a time to be born and a time to die. The time to be born commences everything, and whatever we have done with our life, the time to die concludes it. I think one of the most powerful ways in which some of the considerations of the first eight verses is brought to mind when we remember the Camp David talks, where Yitzhak Rabin and the skunk Yasser Arafat met with the Clinton administration, allegedly to forge a way ahead where peace might be agreed. And Yitzhak Rabin read these verses. He concluded on verse 8, he said, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, the time for peace has come. Was he ever wrong? The whole burden of these verses is that everything is outside of our control. We don't control when we are born even, much less when we die. These verses demonstrate everything that is encountered in our life and the strange, apparently strange opposites that we encounter. Time to born, as we say, and a time to die. There's a time to plant, there's a time to pluck up that which is planted. There's a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, etc., etc. Life is not just an endless, meaningless cycle, but it's an orderly, purposeful arrangement. From the human point of view, it's a life often of great extremes. There are times of great joy. There are times of great sorrow. There's a time when we must love, and there's a time when we must hate, contrary to what humanists tell us. All have their purpose in the providence of God. Bear in mind, just a little castaway thing, there's never a time to do wrong. There's a time for everything here, but there's never a time to do wrong. There is never a time for the works of the flesh, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like. Of the which, as Paul says, I tell you before, as I have told you also in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. So, I know we're aware of this, but let's always remember that there's never a time to do wrong. There's a time for all these things here. There's a time for sadness, there's a time for happiness, but there's never a time to do wrong. And these verses should help us to be balanced, because if we look at these verses and think of the various times when we can do all these things, it will help us from falling into one extreme or the other. Like verse 2, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up. As Christ said in Luke chapter 13, a certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of the vineyard, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down, why cumbereth it the ground? And he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig it about and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well, and if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. There was a time to cut down that fig tree. If it didn't bear fruit, it was to be cut down. Now we automatically think that in God's eyes, when we stand before the judge of all the earth, we will be cut down. If we don't bear fruit, we will be cut down. But even in our lives, perhaps, is a parallel. There's a time for fellowship and a time to refrain from fellowship. There's a time to deal with human beings and there's a time not to deal with human beings. There's a time to have associations with human beings and there's a time not to have associations with human beings. And there's a time to cease from having association with other human beings. For example, the espousal of wrong doctrine. That is a time when we cease to have dealings with other human beings. It's a time to cut off or cut down. Verse 6. There's a time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. This is probably very pertinent, especially in regards to our comments yesterday, because we're all very able to get. Not just are we able to get, but our predilection is to get, and to get more, and to get more again. But what about lose? Are we prepared to lose for the sake of Christ? The world tells us that essentially the more we get, the better off we are, and the better we are esteemed. But Christ says, If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Are we prepared to lose for the truth? If we find our situation one that may compromise our standing before Yahweh, are we prepared to cut things off for the truth? Is the kingdom really as important as we make out? Are our times balanced? Or perhaps is our balance a little bit too much on the getting aspect and not so much the losing? And verse 8 again, especially in this liberal day and age, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. Is there a time to hate? Is there a time for war? Psalm 139, the words of one of the greatest men ever to have walked the earth. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me therefore, ye bloody men, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Yahweh, that hate thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Not his enemies, not David's enemies, Yahweh's enemies. And we hate the doings of the wicked. We hate wickedness. There is a time to hate. And perhaps, turning it on ourselves a little, Hebrews chapter 1 verse 9 says, Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. Yes, we hate the wickedness of the world, and that's right. But perhaps we are a bit remiss in hating the enemy in ourselves. Perhaps we don't hate wickedness in ourselves as much. But we must, because we ourselves are our greatest enemy. Not the world. The world can't make us do anything. Only we make us do wrong. Do we love righteousness? We may hate the evil of the world, but do we hate iniquity? Do we feel wretched when we fail? A time of war and a time of peace. Are we pacifists? We are conscientious objectors, but do we object to war? Brother Robert said in the Christadelphian in 1871, However dreadful war may appear in the eyes of the friends, and probably it appears no less so in the eyes of all sane persons, are we to understand that they absolutely and unqualifiedly, repudiate war? If this be their position, then they are bound to reject the scriptures. They tell the author of the sacred volume that his mode of punishing the wicked is barbarous, cruel, and not in accordance with love and mercy. Argument is not necessary to prove that the wicked are Yahweh's sword to execute judgments upon the wicked. Divine testimony plainly affirms it. In other words, we don't object to war as a concept. We're not pacifists. There is a time for war. Now is not the time for war. But what does Psalm 149 say? Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honour have all his saints. If we are faithful, we will be honoured to initiate and carry out the war against the wicked. But as with everything, there's a time for things, and now is the time to refrain from war. Verse 9. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboureth? What is the purpose of it all? What is the purpose of all these contrasts and extremes that we can experience in our lives? Why does life appear to be such a mixed bag of experiences? Verse 10, I have seen the travail which Elohim hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Or as it could be translated, I have seen the travail which Elohim hath given to the sons of Adam to be humbled by it. For that same word, which is translated exercised there, is also translated elsewhere as humble, afflict, or trouble. So man is to be humbled by all these different experiences. There is a time for happiness. Man would become quite despondent if all we ever experienced was bitterness. So Yahweh, in his providential mercy, and he knows the correct balances, provides us with some positive elements in our life. But man generally is not bettered by prosperity. Look around us. Look at the brotherhood. Prosperity has done us no favours. Every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. So all these things, all these different experiences, are necessary for the development of our characters. As far as the world are concerned, they're just a drop in the ocean. It makes no difference what happens to them. But to the sons of God, all these experiences, divinely measured out in the wisdom of the Father, provide for us the necessary conditions to bring forth fruit unto righteousness. Verse 11, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Or Young's literal says, the whole hath he made beautiful in his season. God has set, Elohim has set the Olam in Adam's heart, in man's heart. This was the whole purpose for the creation of man. To see the time when God would be all in all. But the whole purpose was tarnished by sin and an unhealthy desire on the part of Adam and Eve to be like the Elohim. Humility, I suppose, is the key to understanding the issues of life. To understanding all these issues, the humanist doesn't understand these things. Why? Because they exalt man too much. They think man is like the Elohim. They think they know everything. It actually is like a blanket in front of their eyes. Pride does not allow us to see life in its true perspective. But the humility of the sons of God enables us to see the purpose of all these things. And then when we recognize that we are just flesh and blood, we are just dust and ashes, we will appreciate the way in which Yahweh works in our lives. Humility helps us to understand that to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose. Everything in our lives, this gathering, the experiences, maybe even on our trip home from this gathering, and everything on a day-to-day basis is tending towards the Olam of the Olams, whether we are there or not. Verse 12, is it the most important verse of the whole chapter? Maybe. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Whatever is thrown at us, if we can keep in mind that rejoice and be thankful, everything will work out we would be so much happier for it. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. Again, this is a contrast in itself. A contrast between man's endless, ever-changing cycle of futile, perishing efforts and the eternal, purposeful, unchanging word of God. For man to be happy, we must accept God's plans. 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 24 says, For all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man is the flower of grass. The grass withereth, and the flower thereof falleth away. But the word of the Lord endureth forever. And this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. I'll skip the next few verses to move to the concluding verses in verse 19. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. All go unto one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. This is not so difficult. Man is without doubt the preeminent creature, but here we aren't talking about status, but our natural life's state. Man, in that regard, in terms of mortality, has no preeminence above a beast. And we think of Psalm 49 verse 6. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him, for the redemption of their soul is precious and deceaseth forever. That he should still live forever and not see corruption. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. We think of examples like Washington, Stalingrad, Leningrad, Darwin, etc. They call places after their names, but where are they? They're gone. They will never, ever, ever see the light of day again. Nevertheless, man being in honour abideth not. He is like the beasts that perish. This their way is their folly, yet their posterity approve their sayings, etc. So man has no preeminence above the beast as far as his nature is concerned. He dies, beasts die. Man that is in honour and understandeth not is like the beasts that perish. Brother Thomas says in Helpless Israel, Men and beasts, say the scriptures, have all one ruach or spirit, so that the man hath no preeminence above a beast. The reason assigned for this equality is the oneness of their spirit, which is proved by the fact of their common destiny, as it is written, For all are vanity. That is, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Should sober us up. Life seems so worthwhile. Everything seems so worth getting and holding on to. Life seems to be everything, but it is all vanity. Even if life could offer satisfaction, even if material gain, a wonderful, luxurious lifestyle, even if those things could offer satisfaction, death would very soon rob us of it all. We have a superior intellect to the animal world, but the hand of death claims us all indiscriminately. Verse 21 is widely used by the apostasy. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward, to the earth? And that's automatically jumped on as proof that the spirit, as in our immortal soul, goes to heaven. And presumably that the spirit of the beast goes to hell, poor beasts. But if we look at the verse a little more closely, we will see that there's some disparity there. Solomon did not say, who knows, in relation to the state of the dead. He's talking about the living here. Solomon is not expounding the nature of man. He's talking about the vanity of life, not the vanity of death. There is no vanity in death. The vanity of life is that we do die. So Solomon is questioning the state of the living, not the dead. Brother Robert says, Solomon did not say who knows in reference to the state of the dead, but in reference to the spirit of man and its living operation. It was the essence, constitution, or modus operandi of the living human spirit that was the problem covered in his question. Who knoweth as in the case of the spirit of the beast, which he includes equally in the question. Then Solomon did not own to ignorance as to the state of the dead. He expressly says, as the one, the beast dieth, so dieth the other, man. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. And with irresistible force elsewhere, the dead know not anything. So man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all go to one place. And yet we are supposed to understand that man goes to heaven and the beasts go to somewhere else. Well, the word spirit there does not even necessarily refer to our life. It's the Hebrew word ruach, breath. Elsewhere, it has been translated as mind. And with other uses like breath, air, wind and spirit, it does not refer to the soul. It certainly does not refer to an immortal soul, which does not exist. Let me read to you three examples of this exact same word. In Numbers 14 verse 22, Moses says, "Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him, and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land wherein to he went, and his seed shall possess it." Again, Joshua 5 verse 1 says, "Their heart melted, neither was their spirit in them anymore, because of the children of Israel." And lastly, there are a lot more examples, I'm only choosing three here. 1 Kings chapter 10 verse 4, regarding the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon. "When she saw all the wonders, there was no more spirit in her." Does that mean that she died? It's obvious. We even use the same word today. or at least we use the word anglicized word, spirit, which means more than breath and life. We say sometimes if you have very energetic horses that they're spirited horses. Or if you refer to someone who's quite energetic, you may say they're in high spirits. And that is simply what is being referred to here. Reading from that quote from Elpis Israel earlier, Brother Thomas says, "Yet this one spirit manifests his tendencies differently in men and other creatures. In the former, so in men, it is aspiring and God-defying, rejoicing in its own works and devoted to the vanity of the passing hour. While in the latter, its disposition is grovelling to the earth in all things. Thus the heart of man being deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, who can know or fathom it? Solomon was led to exclaim, 'Who knoweth the spirit of the sons of Adam? Ruach beni he Adam,' which exalts itself to the highest, 'and the spirit of a beast which inclines to the earth.' We may answer, 'None but God only. He knoweth what is in man, and needs not that any should testify of him.'" End quote. So, what we have then is a picture of animals which just do their thing. Man, we have a world full of ambitious people who try and get more and more and more. And occasionally we end up with tyranny, with sort of the Adolf Hitlers and such people of this world who really try to exalt themselves to a point at the expense of others. That's not what beasts do. All they do is operate according to the divinely given program. But man, he keeps trying to make himself greater. That is simply what is meant in this verse. And that's really, I suppose, most of what I wanted to say about this chapter. But just to remember, there's a time for everything. And there will be a time to give account of ourselves. We cannot control the facets of our lives. We cannot control when we're born. We cannot control everything thereafter. And we cannot control when we die. Likewise, we've been called to give account of ourselves when the Son of God returns. When we are called away is out of our hands. What is not out of our hands is whether we are accepted or not.
Thank you, Brother David. We're now open for a discussion on this chapter, Ecclesiastes 3, which Brother David has more than prepared us for. Plenty of subjects in there we can go into. And one thing I would like to ask of everybody, embarrassing as it is, I don't know everybody by your name. So when you raise your hand and I point to you, please don't take any offense that I probably just didn't wake up yet from my coffee. So when you make your remark, would you please tell me what your name is so that my wife, which gets my notes, will know who said what. Even though we will have this on BCAA with probably the computers later on. Appreciate that, if you would do that for me. Just a personal request. Okay, it's now open for discussion, and I see about 100 hands up, right? No, I don't see any. Jim. Jim Somerville. Thank you, Jim.
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, it's interesting to see Solomon's progress so far through the book of Ecclesiastes. In the first chapter, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. There is no good under the sun. He looks at the subjects and he sees nothing there. And then in the second chapter, he tries to rise above the negativism of the first chapter and seeks to say, okay, how do we get out of this? And so he devotes himself to find happiness. And he tries wealth, and he builds cities, and builds houses, and plants vineyards, and has singing maids and singing maidens, and fountains, and et cetera, et cetera. Everything that could be imaginable. And yet, it comes to the same conclusion, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. And now, in this chapter, he changes the scope from looking at man and his environment, and he introduces, it kind of leads itself naturally, if we're following the progression of his thought, to the abstract. He's still taking the worm's eye view, looking at it from the underneath, if you would, not looking at the bird's eye view from above, but still with the worm's eye view, he's introducing a concept that is more abstract, and that is the concept of time. When you introduce the concept of time into what's going on in the earth, you introduce a whole different perspective, and yet introduces another problem. First of all, where he introduces it by showing time by contrasting and comparison what's going on. To everything there is a time and a season. And the largest bookends is a time to be born and a time to die. That's the beginning and the end. And everything has a beginning and everything has an end, as he observes it. But even within those bookends, there's the time element that man can't control. There's a time to plant and a time to reap. Now, I don't know so much about down here. We have warm weather, but if you're in New England, if you're feeling lousy in the spring, but in the fall you're starting to feel pretty good, and you say, I feel good, I think I'll go out and plant my garden. Sorry about that. You missed it. It's out of your control. I don't care how you feel, how good you feel, what you feel like doing. That's out of your control. And so Solomon's bringing this concept to us that although you can control certain things, there's this abstract time that we're all subject to. And it affects what we can do and how we can do it. And it brings the reality that we're not in control. Reminds me of the question to ask a chess player, what's the best move that you can make in a chess game? Well, that depends on the situation at hand. That depends on the timing. You could have made a move that was great 3 moves ago, but now it's the worst move you can make. you know, and it's time. You could have bought a house 3 years ago, and at the top of the market, it's a good thing to buy a house. Great. All of a sudden, the market drops, and it was a terrible decision. But you didn't know it at the time. Stock market, anything like that, any investment. Our lives are controlled by this abstract that we can't control. And the bottom line is, we cannot obtain perfection because we're not in control of time. And there's this abstract hanging over all of us that we've got to accept. Sorry about that. We're not in control. And we can't make good decisions and right decisions and perfect decisions because that abstract element of time sticks its ugly nose in there and interferes with us.
Brother Seth?
Well, I certainly appreciate the comments that Brother David had regarding killing and healing, war and peace. And essentially, it'll provide a nice preview for the lecture, which, God willing, I hope to present Thursday night, on military service. Yes, war is a tool that God has at his disposal to control the flow of things on this earth to bring about his plan. It has been, it's in effect for the wars today, and it will be in the wars tomorrow when the world is conquered. So if this is so, why did Brother David say it's not our time for war now? That's because the wars happening today are made under human decisions. Weak human decisions. What a country thinks is a nice and honorable reason to carry out a war pales in comparison with what is truly honorable in the eyes of God. And how did the nation come to such a decision? We could say kindly, perhaps there's a flawed premise why a nation goes to war. Or we could say more directly to the truth, perhaps a nation goes out of its way to deliberately mislead its citizens as to why a country's going to war. And what are the motives behind it? Is a nation's pride at stake? Is there a desperation for resources? Or is there flat-out greed? Now, I hope to give more concrete examples Thursday night in my lecture. But we come to the point, anything made under human decisions is going to be flawed. And that is why we, especially when it comes to war, it's important we don't get caught up in the national fervor of things, jingoism, as you might call it. It has been and always should be, come ye out from among them and be ye separate.
Brother Burl Snyder. Getting it right so far?
I'd like to kind of get in between Brother Jim's comment and Brother Seth's comment. Brother Jim pointed out about time, how we don't have control of it. And Brother Seth pointed out about there's only going to be one war of purpose, of intent, of necessity that we really need to be concerned about. And that, you look at this, the first verse, where he says there is a time to every purpose under heaven. Everything, there's a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. What is that purpose? That purpose started a long time ago and continues on unto this day. And it is our duty, it's our responsibility to be able to discern those signs. Discern that purpose under heaven. There are signs going on around us all the time of the coming events, of the coming great war, that the one we need to be concerned about. And it's our responsibility as brethren of Christ to be able to discern that sign. Christ berated the Sadducees and the Pharisees, saying that you can discern the face of the sky, but you can't discern the signs of the time. And brothers and sisters, that's a grave responsibility that's been put in our laps, to understand the time for the purpose under heaven.
I know his name. I know he's married to Aldi, and he's Aaron.
Yeah.
Brother Aaron. Myers.
First, I'd like to thank our brother David for his opening remarks. I'd like to provide some insight on verse 21. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? If you think about it, think how a beast breathes, or like think about a dog. They have their nose to the ground, sniffing the ground. All the beasts, their nose is pointed to the ground. And even us, as we're acting like beasts, when we're just looking straight forward, our nostrils are pointed to the ground. But when you look up, you start breathing upward. So you're starting to focus on things above rather than on things below. And I would like to go to John chapter 8, where the Messiah says, "Ye are from beneath, I am from above. Ye are of this world, I am not of this world." He's not speaking literally. He's speaking of his mind. His mind are set on things above. Paul reiterates, set your mind on things on heaven. Don't set your mind on things carnal out of the world. So if you're acting like Adam, which is the spirit of Adam, if you're acting like the Son of Man, you're setting your mind on things above rather than things of the earth. So your nostrils, so to speak, are breathing above rather than breathing like a beast downward.
Brother Gordon Jones. I'm not getting 100% so far.
I'd like to just add this comment on the time for everything. And I think if we added in there is a right time for everything, it would be quite correct. And actually probably describe what Solomon is suggesting here. And in my limited experience, there's a few things there that I think I see that when it says there's a time to be born, I notice my marginal reference says a time to bear. And we do have some control over some of those things. But the real secret, I think, is knowing when the right time is for these things. And anybody that raises livestock will know that there is a proper time to conceive. There's a proper season. And in my little experience with growing things, you might say, well, this springtime is the time to plant. But it gets more complicated than that, in a sense that there is a time, some have suggested even the time of the moon. I'm not sure about that, but certainly there's a right time to plant. And my experience through trial and error is that sometimes you think you're doing it right and you're doing it all wrong, and other times by happenstance you do it right. And so we see the wonderful wisdom of God in the way He's designed things, and it is to our benefit if we can try to understand what is the right time for those things that we do have some control over.
Brother Dan Jackson.
Brother and sister, I just have a question, actually. First thing I was thinking about what Brother Aaron was saying in the looking down and the looking up, I was reminded of the time when the Israelites came out of Egypt, and they began complaining not that far into the wilderness. And what was it they missed? It was the leeks and the onions and all those types of things that were of the ground. They looked down instead of to the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud that was up So just kind of a connection with what Brother Aaron was saying. My question actually comes from verse 18, where he said, I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God test them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. I just wonder if somebody could expound a little bit more on that verse for me.
Brother Sid Jones.
Well, I was actually just looking at verses 16 to 18, and I think there's a connection in there to between all of them. Verse 16, he expresses that in the place of justice there was wickedness, place of righteousness there was wickedness, and it is not in mankind to judge righteous or just judgment. When you leave judgment to mankind, there will be mistakes. The society we live in has largely discarded the death penalty for serious crimes because of the amount of errors that have been committed by the justice system, whether in corruption or in simply mankind's inability to completely understand the situation or to be misled by circumstantial evidence. I said in my heart, verse 17, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. A mankind is expert at judging, at justice on his own level. We are all born with it right within us, the ability, or what we perceive as the ability, to look at the other guy and attribute his motives, decide whether his actions come from right or from wrong motives and motivation, from a wrong heart state, and we're very good at that. We're very poor at catching ourselves at that game. A brother Islip Collier once wrote that when we are in self-examination, it is a very poor system because we are the accused, we are the judge, we are the jury, we are the defense, we are the whole courtroom. There's so much conflict of interest in that courtroom that a real good verdict is very hard to come by. And so what he's really pointing out here is that we are thrown situations amongst ourselves in our own personal lives and in our ecclesial lives where it becomes apparent to us that we simply don't have the capacity to gather all of the information necessary to make a wise judgment. And at some point, we have to realize what he says in verse 18, that God is testing us so that we may learn that we are ourselves but beasts. We are given these things to learn that sometimes God is the only one who knows all the facts, who knows the hearts, who knows what is right and justice and just judgment. And we have to know where to stop.
Brother David Somerville.
I'd just like to build a little bit on what Brother Sid said in referring back to the 10th verse where Brother David talked about how the word exercise could be used as humble. But we know if we go to the gym and work out or do some physical labor that we're not used to doing, we get sore the next day and we're paying for it. But we also know that it's helping us get stronger. And it's the same thing God is doing with our trials. He puts us through these trials so that we can become stronger. And it's not always just by overcoming the trials and giving ourselves a nice pat on the back that we become stronger. Sometimes it's by failure. My students, when they're testing things, they're always nervous about testing it because it might not work right. And I tell them that it's through your failures that you're going to become stronger. And it's something that we, as long as we can look back and learn from it and become stronger, we realize that we are mortal. We do sin and we're not perfect. And if we can learn from that, and it's a lot easier to judge ourselves after we've fallen down and have to pick ourselves up, that we weren't as strong or as good as we might have thought we are. So it's through these travails that we can see ourselves as beast, as human, as sinful, and it's by work that we strengthen ourselves that we can not be like the beast, but be more heavenly.
Brother David Van Pelt.
Brethren and sisters, we see in all of this that's being mentioned today the need for discernment on our part. We're told that the wise will understand. We're also told that we should strive to do things decently and in order. And knowing our Heavenly Father that He does all things according to His plan and purpose with the earth and man upon it on a timely basis. Yes, there's even a time for such tyrants as Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Saddam Hussein and Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Men such as this that have done terrible things. But we realize that overall, God's purpose will be realized. His plan will be realized. People ask all the time, why do we suffer? Why do we have to endure these things? God knows the end from the beginning, and all will work towards that glorious end. But for us, who are the sinful sons of men, it's fitting and calmly that we notice that God always does things on a timely basis, and so should we. We should strive to obey. We're looking at the judges. We're looking at the lives of the patriarchs. We realize that they did things in a proper manner. They strove to serve God. They strove to seek and know and to do His will. And so should we. Whether it be a verse that says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, we should discern that if God has placed wisdom in even these little creatures, if we can learn, there is so much that we can learn how to frame and order our lives, then if we do this, we shall hopefully, through the mercy and love and forbearance and forgiveness of God, obtain mercy in that day. We know that Jesus spoke against the Pharisees and Sadducees, lawyers and scribes. They look at the face of the sky and discern, you know, good or foul weather. But they couldn't discern the times in which they were living. Since there is a proper time for us to work in service and in labor unto our God, then now is the day of salvation. Today is the day of salvation. We are to harden not our hearts as they did in the provocation. There will, if we do these things and strive with our hearts to serve God, and denying all ungodly lust, not living in the pleasures and the deceitfulness of sin of this wicked age, degenerate age, then we shall of the Spirit reap life eternal in that day. It's all where our priorities are. It's all what we esteem life to be about. Abraham Lincoln, a worldly man, as we all know, had a very wise saying. I've always enjoyed that saying because it's really basically what God tells us. Most people are as happy as they make up their minds to be. If we would just remember that in regards to the truth, we'd all go a long way towards getting into that kingdom. It's all a matter of attitude, persuasion, calmness, seemliness, discernment. And we should do that. Solomon, at the end of his life, had failed in many things. Looking over his life, he doubtless was moved deeply. And thus the writing of the book of Ecclesiastes. So let us, while we are in the land of the living, keep in remembrance the hymn that we sing. Life is the time to serve the Lord, to do His will, to learn His word. In death, there's no power to know. Far less in wisdom's way to go.
Have you ever thought that you had room just for a few comments, and then you ran out of space and had to cross out the person's name and put it down further? That's what happened this trip. Sorry for the delay. Brother Aaron Myers.
So going back to verse 18, I said in mine heart, concerning the state of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are peace. So, going off of our brother David Hughes' comments, men try to name lands after themselves so that they will endure forever. And one can only think of Nebuchadnezzar when he built the image of pure gold to show that his kingdom will last forever, that it won't be broken apart. And he was literally transformed into a beast to show that even the highest authority on earth is nothing but a beast compared to God. And we can even... I'm even reminded of Job. When Job was suffering his trials in chapter 38, then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? And who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" So what Yahweh is saying to Job is that he is not a god. Job was being very self-righteous. His mind was set on things of above, but that made him conceited in his righteousness. And he was revealed to be even as a beast and humbled through his experience, and through that humbling, he became even more righteous than he already was. So that's just my answer to verse 18.
Well, so far, some of you have taken the words right out of my mouth, and that's good, because that just means we're all getting pretty close to the same page on things. Brother Philip Hughes.
I'd like to add my thanks to the words that Brother David has given us this morning, developing our understanding of this part of the Word of God. I'd like to make a quotation actually from 1 Corinthians 15, and in verse 32 Paul says, "If after the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage hath it me if the dead rise not?" And we know in that chapter Paul is speaking about the resurrection, and he makes the powerful argument against those who appear to be denying the possibility of a resurrection, that if Christ wasn't raised, then we would be of all men most miserable. We'd be in a hopeless condition. And he adds after that, after he says, what advantageth it me if the dead rise not? Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. He said, well, let's just live a life like the beast. Let's just give it all up. What profit, what meaning is there in life? If Christ is not raised from the dead, there's nothing. There's no hope. It's darkness. It's oblivion. The only ray of light in the midst of prevailing darkness is the greatest fact of history, the resurrection of Christ. And when he said, let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die, he appears to be quoting from the very parts of scripture which we're considering at the moment. Yesterday's readings in chapter 2 and verse 24, there's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. And in verse 13 that we've just read in the chapter, also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. It is the gift of God. And it's kind of interesting, really, that Brother David drew our attention towards the end of the chapter on the powerful verses which prove the mortality of man. And it seems that Paul picks up both threads there. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. He said, if there's no resurrection, then man's mortal, that's it. You know, that is it. Now, as we've been considering the book of Ecclesiastes, we haven't as yet, as has been commented in the earlier part of the week, that we haven't really got into the more positive aspects that Solomon draws attention to and probably concludes in the 12th chapter of his book. But he does hint towards that in the reading. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. So he is, as Brother Jim sort of hinted at, he's drawing us closer and closer to the main issue of life. We this aspect of control and out of control. Life is certainly out of our control. You know, we started off with saying all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. I mean, it's stupendous. I once heard a statistic that it was something like 186,000 cubic miles pour into the oceans every year, and the evaporation process and rain and we have no control over that. Man has no control over the elements of creation. And even as we've been considering today, life, death, even we were having a discussion over breakfast this morning with our brothers and sisters, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away. Rotherham in the Emphasized Bible says, a time to give up that which is lost. Yeah, we spend a lot of time to seek, but then there's a time to give up that which is lost, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Various things are out of our control. And I think what seems to be the situation is that Solomon is drawing our attention to is, amongst other things, don't worry about the things you can't control. Verse 13 again, also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labour. That's not like, let us eat and drink and tomorrow we die. I think Paul was taking that, linking it with the mortality of man and the absence of the purpose of God in the resurrection of Christ. But at this point in time, Ecclesiastes, in the absence of the purpose of God, life is hopeless. There's nothing we can do about it. Yeah. I think Brother Grocott says it's like gnawing on the bars of a gate or of a cage. You know, the knowledge that of the hopelessness of mankind only makes things worse. Brother Grocott had the exhortation says a beast going to mortality is ignorant and is sort of like content. He says a man knowing that is a misery. But with the purpose of God, with the plan and purpose of the art, if we accept these things, then it is a great life of joy and happiness. And Brother David Van Pelt sort of hinted that in the quotation that he made from Abraham Lincoln. I hadn't heard it before, but yeah, we can develop our mental habitude to the plan and purpose of God and accepting what we can't change. Brother Grocott also said happiness is contentment with things as they are, not as what we would want them to be. And the time to live, the time to die, the time to this, the time to that. In verse 17, I said, my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. And there is a time, there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. And Brother David's exhortation to us was that, you know, there will be a time when we have to give an account at the judgment seat. And our wisdom is to adapt our minds to these things we can't control, but to accept in its simplicity the life which God would have us lead.